Welcome to AUSA's Army Matters. This is Army Real Talk with Nzinga Curry
and Major Eugene Irving. Now let's get real.
Today's show will focus on financial management. We are going to speak with two experts who will share a few tools and practices that hopefully can be incorporated to strengthen our financial portfolio. Major Irby, are you ready for today's podcast?
Absolutely. Now, before we get started, I would like to take a moment to read a brief financial advisor disclaimer. Any opinions shared by either Colonel Galing or Colonel Troutman are theirs and theirs alone and do not constitute the official position of the Department of Defense, the U.S. Army, or the Association of United States Army. This podcast is not intended to serve as a basis for providing individual personal financial advice. If you are seeking individual financial advice, please utilize the numerous military options, such as, but not limited to, Military OneSource, Army Community Services, and many chaplain offices also provide financial management advice. Of course, another option is to seek out financial advice from a personal financial management expert.
Excellent. Good information to share. But now I'm ready to learn. So let's welcome our guests. We first have Colonel Retired Mark Trotman, as well as Colonel Retired Steve Galen. Welcome. And please share a little bit about yourself and the company that you are representing.
Ms. Curry and Major Irby, I'm retired Colonel Steve Galing. Thank you very much for the opportunity to talk about financial management today. Just a little background on my military service and federal service with the government. I retired after active duty with the Army in 2007, after 27 years. My basic branch was finance, but I spent over 15 years in operations research, or ORSA, as our listeners would recognize it. After retiring, I then served 8 years in the federal government as the Deputy Director of Military Compensation Policy, Office of Secretary of Defense, and then 2 years as a lead analyst in an analytical directorate for the Chief of Military Personnel Policy, also in the Office of Secretary of Defense. After completing the Certified Financial Planning curriculum at Georgetown, I joined the American Armed Forces Mutual Aid Association Wealth Management and Trust Team as a relationship manager. I joined and I'm here really for only one reason, and that is to give the best possible financial advice to our active duty, reserve, National Guard, and our retired veterans, and those that have not retired but served honorably as a veteran. Just a little background, AFMA Wealth Management Trust was established in 2012. It is owned by the American Armed Forces Mutual Aid Association, AFMA for short, a 140-year-old nonprofit organization established after the Battle of Little Bighorn to assist survivors and their family members, a mission that is clearly at the heart and soul of AFMA. Thank you.
Thank you very much, and thank you for your service.
Thank you. Good morning, Ms. Curry and Major Irby. It's just a real pleasure to be here. My name is Mark Trotman. I am also an Army veteran, 28 years. Armor was my basic branch. I gravitated towards the latter part of my career towards strategic plans and policy. Along the way, I had the privilege to teach economics as an active duty member. There I earned, and during that tour, I earned my certified financial planner designation and took up the business of researching and educating in financial matters. So that's how I got into this particular business. I've authored several pieces in the financial management field tailored towards service members. And now in my post-military career, I transitioned in 2011. I've gone into the education sector. I'm adjunct faculty at George Mason University. I helped them set the seeds to begin a certified financial planner program at that university, and write and consult in the field of financial management. I still practice a little bit in the financial planning field, but of late, I have consulted to West Financial, which is a division of Sandy Spring Bank, and with my colleague there, Kirk Taylor. He's been a wonderful research partner in putting together what we have named the transition initiative that is dedicated to helping people who have served, transition well, make good financial decisions, and find financial independence in their second career. So like all of the rest of the attendants here, I can already pick up that all of us have a passion for this work. My particular area, it's in the research and education aspect of financial planning.
Very nice. I thank you as well for your service. And it looks like, listeners, we are here with some knowledgeable folks. So I'm going to just jump into the questions. But before I dive too deeply, I must ask the question or ask to have distinguished the difference between DA civilian and military retirement plans.
Let me go ahead and answer that question for you. First off, when we talk about DA civilians, there is typically two retirement programs. One is almost totally phased out. It's called the Civil Service Retirement System, or CSRS. That was for individuals that have been serving since before 1 January 1987. Everyone after 1 January 1987 is under FERS, also known as the Federal Employee Retirement System. So what I'll describe here are the immediate voluntary retirement programs for DA civilians, because there is a whole host of disability variations of the program. But I think for the vast majority of our listeners, the immediate voluntary programs are the ones that they would be most interested in.
Okay.
And there's really three of them. The first one applies if you have served at least 30 years and you have reached your minimum retirement age. Now, if you were born after 1970, your minimum retirement age is 57. There's a whole table that if you were born prior to 1970, it's a little bit earlier than that. But if you have served 30 years and hit your minimum retirement age, then you can, in fact, draw your full FERS retirement at that point in time. The second category would be individuals that have served at least 20 years and are 60 years or older. And then the third category would be if you're 62 or older and served at least 5 years. So those are the three general categories. You can think of DA civilian retirement as really a three-legged stool. The first leg of the stool is the FERS annuity. And that is for less than 20 years of service, that's 1% of your highest 3 years salary. If you serve over 20 years, you get a 10% bump up. So it's 1.1% times the average of your highest 3 years times your number of years. So that's the way that that one leg of that three-legged stool is computed. The second leg of that stool is the Thrift Savings Plan, or TSP. That really depends on how much you contributed to the TSP and, of course, how the investments that you selected in the TSP performed. And also, of course, it depends on when you take it, and we'll talk about that a little bit later. And then the third leg of that stool is your Social Security entitlement. And again, we'll talk a little bit more about that, but typically we recommend to individuals that they wait until their full retirement age, or FRA, in order to begin drawing Social Security. So again, for most of our listeners, since this is targeted towards the younger generation, that's age 67. So 67 to 70 is typically what we would recommend.
Wonderful.
Okay, great. And I'll pick up and add to that both the military retirement system, but also what I've experienced in private industry. And like Steve, spent some time as a government civilian as well. So would absolutely underline everything that he has said about the government retirement system. Much like the government retirement system, the military retirement system has undergone a period of change. And where we find ourselves now is in the blended retirement system. Much like the government retirement system, the new blended retirement system consists of those three parts of a defined retirement annuity, a participation in the Thrift Savings Plan, and then a very strong recommendation to think about and incorporate into your planning the Social Security retirement annuity, because as with the rest of the general population, military members are participants in the Social Security system. What the blended retirement system did was replace a legacy retirement system that was put in place shortly after the Second World War and functioned for over 40 years. And I won't make any comments on Steve's age, but I know that he was covered under that one as well, as I was. Unlike the blended retirement system, The legacy retirement system, the system under which Steve and I grew up, was just a single retirement annuity based on 2.5% of either your final retirement pay, if you were commissioned before 1980, or if you entered active duty before 1980, or if you entered active duty post 1980, based on the average of your high three earning years as an active duty member. So for most of your listeners who are active duty, they are either part of the legacy retirement system, which is based on that high three annuity, or they are participants in the blended retirement system. And the blended retirement system is the system of record, which here on out will be the retirement system for active duty military personnel. This pattern of blending retirement systems of part annuity, part contribution-based investment systems, and some accounting of your Social Security, this is a trend that has become much, much more commonplace in private industry. And in fact, this was a trend that industry began to take up about post-1980. So in a lot of ways, service members now enjoy the advantage of having a lot of the benefits that they would find out in private society. So in a lot of ways, even though the retirement system has become much more complicated than the system that Steve and I grew up in, it's got a lot more opportunities for service members.
Yeah, if I could just dovetail on Mark's comments, and you did a wonderful job summarizing the difference between the two programs and the background of the legacy and the BRS systems. One of the driving factors here was we being the Department of Defense when I was a civilian employee, kept hearing in terms of feedback from soldiers and other members of all the services that it's a great retirement program. We love it. However, you have to serve at least 20 years to be eligible. Otherwise, if you serve just, say, 4 years, 8 years, any other time period, you leave and you have no annuity because you didn't stay the minimum time in service. So that really brought about the first thought that we need to come up with something that when our members serve honorably, that they walk away with something in a retirement program. And hence, the blended retirement system is really the outcrop of that initial conversation and initial feedback, which came from our members.
Okay, good information. We appreciate the distinction, as well as talking about the blended retirement versus the 20-year retirement plan. Could you now speak about the contribution levels?
Sure, can I pick that one
sure,
up?
Sure, okay. Go ahead.
Ms. Curry, what you're making reference to is contribution level being the participation in the thrift.
Yes.
Savings plan.
Thank you.
So let me go a little bit deeper than that. Much as with the civilian retirement plan, the government civilian retirement plan, the new introduction to the blended retirement system is the participation in the thrift savings plan. What's new and really exciting for service members is now with service member contributions comes a government match. And that is something that is very competitive now with private sector companies. This idea of you put in some contributions and your employer will match them with what amounts to free money. And I think you might agree with it. There are a few things that are free in this world, but that's actually one of them is the contribution level for the thrift savings plans.
Right. Just a couple follow-on comments to it, Mark, there. The matching that Mark was talking about is exactly the same as the matching that the DA civilian would also receive.
Mm-hmm. Okay. That's good to know.
So for members, when they assess in the military, the automatic contribution is 3% of their basic pay. So they can, of course, cancel that if they'd like to, but we would highly recommend they not do that, but automatically they will be enrolled at 3%. So right now to get the full 5% matching that Mark referred to, they need to increase to 5%. And we would tell all of our members to do that at the accession point when they're given the paperwork at the basic training or if their officers go into their initial.
Absolutely.
Now, as far as civilians go, same thing. They are initially enrolled at 3%. That will escalate, if you will, to 5%. So that will be In the future, when this podcast is being presented, it's still 3%, but it will eventually be 5% automatic. The other thing, though, too, that our listeners need to be aware of, that you can contribute up to the IRS limit for the particular tax year. So for 2019, that's $19,000. If you're over age 50, and if you could turn 50 on January 1, you're eligible for that entire year to add an additional $6,000 catch-up, as it is known. So I encourage individuals, put in the minimum of your 5% basic pay. Don't miss out on the free money that Mark talked about. But also, if you can put in more, go ahead and do so. And we'll talk a little bit later about making sure that you also invest so you have down payment for a house one day and other major purchases. So putting in retirement is very important, but as a minimum, make it 5%. Put in more if you can, but also realize that there's also a balancing act here to be maintained.
Right. Now, I understand that it's two different account types, one being a traditional and one being Roth. Can you explain that to the audience, what the difference between those two?
The scenario that we described, and I'll put it in terms of the traditional account contributions, those traditional account contributions, and think of these like a 401k type plan, those are made with what are referred to as before tax dollars. So essentially what you're doing is you're taking whatever your base pay level is, and before the United States government gets in there and taxes that pay, you get to put that into your TSP account, or your, you know, what would be in civilian parlance your 401k type account. Those contributions into that account, which you'll pay tax on up front, they grow tax-free or tax-deferred until the time that you draw them out, and the earliest that you could draw them out would be age 59 and a half. I think Steve would agree with me that the recommendation that I give to people is let them in and grow until your mandatory draw out point, which is age 70 and a half. That's the traditional contribution. Tax-free up front, grows tax-deferred, and then when it comes out, it's taxed at whatever rate you have way out there, either at age 59 and a half or age 70 and a half. The way to think about that is whatever your tax rate is out there, that out there point, either 59 and a half or 70 and a half, that quite possibly, it, given your circumstances, it might be lower than your tax rate now when you make your contribution. That's the traditional route. The Roth contribution route is, in terms of taxation, exactly the opposite around. So in other words, your contribution you make with after tax dollars, what you gain from that is tax deferred growth of your investment base. And then when you draw it out, it's tax free. And so the advantage of that approach is if your tax rate now is quite high, and you expect your tax rate in retirement to be much lower, go ahead and use the Roth option and put it in taxable now in order to get that tax-free down the road. Most financial advisors, and I asked Steve on of his opinion of this, that's one of those points where you've got to do a little thinking and decide which approach is best for you. And often it will be a mix of both approaches, and that approach will change over time. For instance, what I found on active duty is because a lot of active duty pay is shielded from tax, it made a whole lot of sense to go a Roth contribution or account and then earn the benefit that if I've done right by employment and investing, well, I'm going to have a considerable amount of income in retirement. Well, it's sure nice to have that tax-free source of income in retirement. What I found after transition, and this has been some of the research that I've done both in an academic sense and for folks, is my income is much higher, my tax liability is much higher, And so then, therefore, it makes a whole lot more sense to go the before tax route and reduce my taxable income, even though I might get hit in retirement. And that's kind of the seeds of that mixed approach of optimizing your income flows over time. Steve?
Yes. Mark's comment on whether you're better off putting into the traditional or the Roth IRA, Roth TSP, I'm sorry, is a very good question. And your comment on the tax rate being lower while you're on active duty is absolutely correct. Almost everyone, after you retire, you have retirement income, then you have a second career, and typically that will put you in a much higher tax bracket. So at that point, you would want to put something in a 401k, or if you're in a higher tax bracket now, put it into the traditional as a pre-tax.
All right, outstanding. Okay, so I guess good information on the thrift saving plan and planning for retirement. Now that we have, our audience has their retirement plan set on autopilot, maybe it's time to go out and buy that new Ford Mustang or maybe even that nice shiny BMW.
I think the gentleman here would probably disagree, as the TSP is just one slice of the financial pie. With that, what advice would you give an individual who is setting up a household budget as well as establishing an emergency fund?
May I start?
Sure, go ahead.
And then Steve, jump in. My advice is really simple.
BMW.
Make a budget, start now.
Very nice.
And Major Irby, to your point, buy used.
Yeah,
there you go.
Well, Mark, the matter is, though, and Major Irby, the matter is, the last five cars I bought have all been used. So take it for what it's worth.
Drives off the lot.
Exactly.
That's right.
20-30% almost a block away. So I always encourage people to take a look at the used cars. Yes, I echo exactly what Mark said in terms of your expenses. In order to develop an effective budget, you have to know what you're spending. So what I encourage everyone to do is keep track of your expenses for 3 months. And I say 3 months because some bills only come quarterly. So keep track of what you're spending your money on, and then take a look back and see what is discretionary and what is essential. I would put essential expenses, your rent, your mortgage if you own a house, your car insurance, food, certainly, gas, clothing, those types of things that you absolutely cannot live without. Those are essential expenses, and that really is your core. In other words, you have to make sure that you can cover your essential expenses. So we encourage everyone, if you're single, typically to have at least 3 months worth of expenses set aside in an emergency fund for those absolutely essential expenses. Mm-hmm. And then if you're married, about 6 months.
Okay.
Then take a look at your discretionary spending and see perhaps where you can cut. And if you're not investing and saving, that's where you can target your percentage for saving and investing.
Okay. So question about that. You spoke about single 3 months, married 6 months in regards to the emergency fund. How does one start that building that? Should they, you know, go hard and say, okay, I'm going to, you know, take all this money and put it into the account, and then something happens and it might not move forward? Or should they start little by little? What is the recommendation as far as how someone should at least start to building their emergency fund?
Sure. Let me pick that up and then turn it over to Steve. It goes on that comment of make a plan and start now. And I think Steve is pointed out really excellently. You've got to be flexible in your plans, because we all know that the plans never survive first contact with the enemy. And the enemy here is uncertainty and in budgets there are, you know, lots of uncertainty, which leads to your comment about how do you build that emergency fund. The best advice I have seen, and the advice that I give to folks, is obviously it depends on your circumstances. All of our circumstances are unique, but you're really better off to take a mixed approach of begin to build your emergency fund as you fund your long-term plans, as you fund your retirement plans.
Very good.
So if, say, for instance, you're able to build a budget and you're able, in, you know, the best of worlds to, you know, to carve out, say, 15% of your pay, let's say. By all means, take that first 5%, put it into the TSP account, gain that other 5% in terms of contribution, and then take the rest of a disciplined savings plan, take some of it, fund your emergency fund until it's built to that 3 to 6 month core expenses point that Steve made reference to, and take and build your long-term plans. Military members have a wonderful advantage in this regard, and that is the United States government found something out in 1783 that it's a really, really good idea to keep military members paid and paid consistently. And military pay, I point to military members, and DoD pay it's got that great advantage of, you know what it is, and you know when it's coming in, and it's consistent. Right. And Congress has been very generous to military members and kept it competitive with inflation over time. And that's a fantastic advantage for military members, that you know what it is, you know when it's coming in, you actually have a good idea of when it might increase with your promotion points, and it generally, usually, normally stays competitive with, or you know, keeps pace with inflation, maybe a little bit more. That is a fantastic advantage that then, if you put some discipline on that, build a budget, pay yourself first by savings, then you have that option of build your emergency fund, build your long-term plan, and do it gradually over time.
Very nice. Good practical advice. All right. So home ownership, we know that is the American dream. So what advice or recommendations would you give when someone is considering to purchase a home? What should they prepare to do before as well as during the process?
I'll take the first cut at that one. What I tell individuals, and I followed my own advice, but I bought three different homes along the way as I PCS from one location to another. The first thing I would tell everyone is understand what the limit is in terms of your mortgage. So you need to understand how much can you afford to pay each month. And then number two, take a look at how much can you put down as a down payment. If you can put 20% down or more, then of course you avoid PMI, primary mortgage insurance, which is another fee that you definitely do not want to pay. If you cannot put 20% or more down on your home, then you're eligible, of course, for a VA loan, if you've never used your VA eligibility before. And so I would highly encourage individuals to take a look at that perspective as well.
I think Steve has laid out perfectly the advice I give to folks. And I know there are going to be a lot of listeners like my wife in the audience who this may gain me a little bit of hate and discontent. I look at a home as a business decision, and it's, the home is a capital asset that's just like any other capital asset that you have. It provides you a service. Mm-hmm. Provides you a service of a roof over your head and all of that sort of stuff, and a place to raise your family and all of those things that then begin to take meaning over time. Well, you've got to not only be able to finance that, and you're exactly right, thinking about that combination of down payment and those long-lived payments over time, called your mortgage, and what will happen someday when you sell that house. So all of that is the basis of a business decision. But then you have to think about the operating costs of that asset over time, the insurance, the maintenance on it, all of those sorts of things. What I advise folks, and this is one of those places where a little bit of independent advice can really be great in the decision making, is lay out all of those costs over time, just like any other business decision that you would make, and ask yourself whether you're better off buying over time or renting. And a lot of that, again, gets back to the individual circumstances of where you find yourself at any particular time.
And I think I love that. And I'll chime in. You need to scale it according to what you're buying. When I bought a condo, Absolutely. It was very different. And now I have a single family home. The maintenance costs increased significantly. So I think that is excellent, excellent advice. Yeah.
Now that we talked about retirement plans a little bit, budgets, home ownership, I think another topic that's very important, it's wills. Can we talk a little bit about the importance of establishing wills, and then how often do you suggest reviewing them and updating those?
Sure, absolutely. You know, to the second point, there's only two things that are certain in this life. We've talked about one, and that is taxes. And of course, you got to talk about the other is when we pass from this life. And that brings up the subject of wills, something extraordinarily important for service members to think about, because we are in a dangerous profession. And you have to wrestle with the fact that the worst could happen. And the best time to think about what to do in crisis is before a crisis. And it's remarkable how many service members that I talk to that you say that to them. And of course, they know that. We're all we're steeped in that as military professionals. But then you say, well, if you thought about it well, oh, my gosh, that's a really scary thing. Just like any other piece of financial planning, a will is very driven by the circumstances financially in the life stage where you find yourself. A couple of fictions to disabuse, I guess, is I'm single. I don't need a will. Well, really not true. Really not true. That's really a great time to think about a will for the practical circumstances, because especially if you're a service member, there are assets that you accrue even in your young service life that you've got to make a decision where they go. The proceeds of your life insurance, say, perhaps, whether it be the serviceman's group life insurance or a private coverage that you might have. Mm-hmm. What you want done with that flashy Mustang that you bought after you took Steve and I's recommendation. You bought it used, save yourself some money, yeah. And you know what to do with those invested assets. That again, once you took Colonel Galing's and MI's advice, and you saved that money on the car that you bought while you invested it, and now you have some assets.
Absolutely.
And if you follow good advice, well, you have this wonderful problem of what do I do with all of these things. And all of us, I don't care who we are, have some preferences of where we would like to see those things add up. And then it becomes wonderfully more complex over time. That as you add spouses and children and family to that, now there are considerations of how those decisions ought to play themselves out. All of that. You codify in a will, which is really your wishes of what is done with what you've worked really hard to do that you can't take with you,
right,
when you pass from this world.
You also asked the question about how often should you have a will, and my typical answer is whenever you've had a change, a life change. If you're single, and of course everyone knows if you get married, you should do a will because now you have a spouse. But that also applies, for example, if you happen to go through a divorce, you would need to redraw your will. Or if something changes in your family dynamics, you have an adult child that gets married, has children, maybe you want to leave something to the grandchildren. Maybe if your adult child gets divorced, you don't want something to his or her former spouse. There's all kinds of situations that can come up. So look at your will whenever you have a life event that perhaps would change it. The other point to note is that military can use a staff judge advocate on your installation to withdraw your will up. It's a nice benefit of being in the military. You don't need to go to a civilian attorney out in town and pay whatever the cost is for a will. So that's one big thing. Second thing is that without a will, just so you know, or even with a will, you are subject to probate. And a lot of people think probate is something that is to be completely avoided. And that's really not the case either, because probate is a systematic way for your estate to be settled. However, if you want things to pass outside of probate, life insurance, like Mark mentioned, is one of them, you have a beneficiary listed on your life insurance policy, that will pass to the beneficiary without going through the will. So same thing with your IRA or your 403B or your thrift savings plan, whatever type of qualified retirement account you have, it passes to the beneficiary or beneficiaries without going through your will.
Now, one other thing that was discussed, I would like to kind of explore more. Just this past weekend, I was having a conversation with a GS friend of mine and another service member that's going to be retiring soon. But everyone kind of had the same question about life insurance, because when you're on active duty, we have a plan established. GS employees has something similar to it also. But exploring other options, you know, the whole life, the terms, and all the blended ones that's out there. What would you recommend for our listeners to research, explore, or maybe even adopt in their overall plan?
Go ahead. Oh, sure. I'll take a cut at that question. First off, there's two basic types of life insurance. There's term life insurance and there's whole life. Now, there's variants of whole life called universal life or adjustable life, if you will, and I'll talk about that in just a moment. The term insurance is just that. It's for a set term, number of years. Typical would be 20 years, sometimes 30, but most of the time it's 20 when you're talking life insurance. I'll use myself as an example. I have a term life policy that I took out when I was 45 years old, 20-year policy, $500,000 term insurance policy. At age 65, it's done. If I'm still alive at age 65, which I certainly hope I am, then the policy is worthless. It's worth zero. But it covered me for that 20-year period. And I selected the dollar amount so that my wife, or if I pass, obviously widow, and my kids at the time living, would have money to go to college, pay off the mortgage of the house, take care of all those debts or any potential type of debts that I would have incurred at that moment in time, plus give them a little extra to live with while my widow would determine what is she wants to do. So that's one way that you can insure yourself. In terms of the dollar amount that you want to try and cover there, it's based on what those expenses are that you would be leaving behind, like a mortgage, perhaps car notes, college bills, if you wanted to send your children to college. Or you could look at it from the standpoint of, what would I earn if I was still alive to replace my lost income, because I'm no longer part of the earning income in the family. So that's kind of the way you would look at the term. The whole life, though, is just that. It's expected that the insurance company will eventually pay that off. And so the premiums tend to be much higher for the same amount of coverage. So a $500,000 term policy might be the same cost as a $200,000 whole life policy. The difference is with the whole life, you have cash value that you build up over time. So if you want to terminate the policy, you can draw whatever cash happens to be in it. Of course, if you pay the premiums, which they're set when you're younger in life, the premiums would be much, much higher, say, when you're age 90, but it's the same premium that it was when you took out the policy. So the bottom line is that you've got that coverage as long as you pay your premium. So I recommend people have a mix of both term and whole life. Universal life is a little different in that you can take that cash value and you can direct how it's invested. The company that you're insuring with can invest it. Typically, they'll guarantee you today, maybe 4.5% return, or you can invest it in securities if you like, which I've done with one of my other policies. So I have selected to have different asset classes for that cash value. So I'm actually earning about 8.5% to 9% return, which is used to buy more insurance. So that keeps my premiums down. So now if the stock market were to tank, for example, all of a sudden, the life insurance company would come back and say, look, Steve, your policy cash value is going to run out here in 2 or 3 years. If you want to keep the policy, you need to increase your premiums. So there is some risk there with a universal life policy. So, but those are the basic policies, term, whole life, and then a variant, which would be universal life.
Sure. And Steve used a key word here, and that is that overall concept of risk, which is another important consideration in your overall financial plan. The risk in this case, again, to disabuse our listeners of why is it called life insurance? Because literally you're insuring your life, and because what it really should be called, and that is death insurance. I don't think you'd sell too many policies if you're an insurance agent. Probably and you not. Say, would you like to buy some death insurance? That sounds pretty bad. Obviously, the asset there is the member's earning capacity, which is considerable. So this idea of taking a look at a risk-based approach of what would happen if the worst happened and we lost and we lost the primary earner. And I would add to what Steve mentioned as well, and that is, think of especially if you're a married person, think of both partners, because it takes two to make the household. That think about what the risks are. What financial, obviously we can't replace anyone with finances, but what we can do is make up for what that earning capacity might be, or what those expenses might be to cover by this vehicle of life insurance, and then buy the solution that's appropriate for the risk.
Yeah, very, very good point, Mark. One thing I would have our members think about, particularly our younger members that are just married, maybe have a toddler at the house, or maybe you know some child that's just now starting school. Say one spouse does not work and is a caregiver at home, and household sex, we should use that term. You also need to have insurance for that individual mm-hmm. as well. And the reason why is because if something were to happen to, you know, household six, you're still going to have to take care of that child. If they're under 4 or 5 years old, they're going to have to go to a caregiver during the day. You might have to hire somebody. So you have, even though someone is not out earning a paid income or W-2 salary, as we might say, that doesn't mean that there aren't expenses associated with that other spouse, what that spouse does for the family. So you need to keep that in mind as well.
So I have a question. Major Irby spoke about a friend, I suppose, that is separating from the Army. It is my understanding, and I may be incorrect, when you retire from the government, if you have an insurance policy with, I believe, OPM or underneath OPM, you can continue that insurance policy. Does the Army have the same option? Oh, not the Army or the military in general. Do they have the same option?
I think what you're asking about is Servicemen's Group Life Insurance, yes, SGLI. Yes, yes, yes. The short answer is no. Okay. SGLI is for while you're serving.
Okay.
Now, when you retire, you are eligible for what is known as vaguely Veterans Group Life Insurance.
Okay.
Veterans Group Life Insurance it's run by the VA. Mm-hmm. VGLI is really designed for those members who are uninsurable after they leave active duty. Mm-hmm. Say they've been severely wounded and they just can't go out and hire or buy a commercial life insurance product.
Okay.
VGLI, however, can be purchased by them.
Okay.
The rates on VGLI tend to be higher than other rates. So there is a premium there to be paid, yeah, but it is automatically available to anyone who leaves the service.
Okay.
So, but I would tell you again to take a look at the premiums, okay, and take a look at your need.
Okay, yep. Sounds good.
Absolutely.
Very nice. All right. So this was a really good conversation, a lot of information. I'm hoping our listeners enjoyed and learned something. To all of our listeners, thank you for joining us. Be sure to subscribe to Army Matters on Apple Podcasts and everywhere else podcasts are found. You can also find us at ausa.org/podcast.
Keep it locked here for all Army Matters and for next week's episode with Family Voices featuring Miss Patty Barron. AUSA is the U.S. Army's professional association, a voice for the Army and support for the soldiers.
For more information about AUSA or to become a member, visit ausa.org. And remember to have a great Army Day.
Hooah!